Ronnie Taylor is a nurse practitioner at Meriden Hospital, which is east of Perth. She wanted to be a nurse ever since she was a kid. When she completed her training, Ronnie went to work in Alice Springs. And she also went out to some remote desert communities. And she had to grow up fast because the health conditions in these places were often awful and shocking. She was on duty when an angry drunk truckie drove his semi-trailer right into a motel bar near Uluru. And he killed 5 people and injured 16 more. Ronnie has helped patients who were incredibly grateful and others who tried to kill her. In Darwin, she became an emergency nurse specialising in trauma. And despite all the drama, the blood and the chaos, she found the work deeply satisfying. Ronnie was there when victims of the Bali bombing were flown in for emergency treatment. She was part of the emergency response teams sent to Pakistan after the floods and the Philippines after the typhoon. And in between all that, she managed to save the life of a frill-necked lizard in an unconventionally conventional way. I thought Ronnie would be made of steel, but in fact, she's a big softie. I don't know how you do this line of work as emergency nursing, Ronnie. It seems really terrifying to me. Is it terrifying to you in any way?
No, not at all. It's never, ever, ever dull. And I can't imagine not doing that as a job now after many, many years of doing it. And that's the beauty, I think, that keeps me in it, is because it's so fascinating.
Let's start with your life right from the beginning. You spent your first years as a little girl in Melbourne and then your family was off. Tell me how your dad told you and the family that you were leaving Melbourne behind.
Well, I think things that I remember around that transition was that, you know, we got our first real television and a very, very nice house in a lovely Melbourne suburb. And we'd only just moved in and things were all set up and suddenly we were told that we were going to be going overseas and there would be no television and, you know, it was going to be a very different life to suburban Melbourne.
Where did he tell you were going?
So off to Nauru Island in the Central Pacific, which is now currently, of course, where a lot of asylum seekers are detained.
Why were you going to Nauru?
So Dad was in the personnel business with the phosphate mine. So Nauru was the smallest, richest republic in the world at that stage, and the Nauruans had a lot of royalties from the phosphate, and employees to work in the mines came from all regions of the Pacific and China. Dad was doing a lot of recruiting, and so we were going to be based in the Pacific.
Now, Nauru back then, not so much now, was essentially a gigantic cone of Batwana, wasn't it?
Yes.
Bat poo, really.
Yes.
That's why it was so valuable, wasn't it?
Correct. And now it's mined out, basically. There's lots of pinnacles still, but a lot of the guana's gone.
Back then it was the glory days, wasn't it? And there was so much money to be had.
Huge money to be had, particularly for, I think, the locals. You know, they were making the money from the royalties and, you know, you saw investments like Nauru House in Melbourne, which, you know, was the tallest building back then, and they did invest. They had their own airline and were trying to be very self-sufficient, but I think they did have some economic woes and have continued to do so ever since.
What do you remember about arriving in Nauru? What pictures do you have in your head of that?
Well, we arrived very late at night and Dad was already on the island and, you know, he'd come to the airport to meet us, and I remember the humidity hopping off the plane. It was just extremely humid and lots of palm trees and, you know, smelling the ocean, and couldn't see a lot that night, but you know, by the next morning, my brother and I were full on in exploration mode of the island, and, you know, it was extremely green and tropical. A lot of World War II relics, lots and lots, because obviously, you know, that was quite the theatre of war, Second World War, and so
unexploded bombs, that kind of thing?
Unexploded ordnance, and there was all sorts of remnants left over, and my brother and I would play in these jungles in, you know, Japanese pillboxes where the, you know, the Japanese would hide out, and we saw lots of very different things there.
Sounds like great fun for kids. I wonder how your mum felt about going off to Guano Island.
I don't know, she really... Oh, mum was never as happy as we were there, I don't think. You know, there's very little fresh produce. We had to rely on boats to bring things in, and so lots of produce was tinned and always seemed to be in short supply, but, you know, you had plenty of fish and tropical fruits and things and an amazing ocean, so I think it was much better for the children than the wives of, you know, the workers there.
Did you feel isolated?
I didn't at all, even though it's only about 26 kilometres round. To me, it was just a wonderful island. I felt, you know, we were very far away from Australia, obviously, and telephones were a little bit of a problem. There was no television, and we had to wait, you know, for when the boats came in. Like, my grandmother came a couple of times on a boat, and she'd have to sit out in the harbour for a couple of days while the boats went through quarantine. So that was hard, just knowing that my nana was on the boat and not getting onto the island.
And then you had to go.
And then we had to leave. When I was 12, I had to start getting ready for high school, and so my parents decided it was time to go back to Australia again.
So how long were you back in Melbourne for?
I think the family had 6 months in Melbourne before Dad announced that we were up and leaving to the Northern Territory.
Life in the Territory is so different from life in Melbourne. Were you prepared for that?
Well, I was still getting over the shock of coming off Nauru Island to Melbourne, and then suddenly I was thrust into the Northern Territory. I was able to fly up to Alice Springs and then get a very small plane from Alice Springs to Tennant Creek, and my family met me at the airport in Tennant, and I remember as I was flying in, it was just all red dirt. It's all I could see was red dirt and a couple of tin sheds, and I thought they'd sent me to Mars. I had no idea.
Because it does look like Mars, doesn't it? I mean, it's like red earth.
And we were even out of Tennant Creek, so we were very rural at another little mine, Warrego Mine, which is about 45 minutes out of Tennant. And so it was an extremely, extremely remote.
What could you do there as a kid?
Sports. There was, you know, certainly swimming. There was a swimming pool, which I've always loved the water. I had a pretty good time there. It was a culture shock to start with, though. You know, I'd come from an island in the Pacific where islanders, you know, were very embracing of us and vice versa, and to Tennant, which was, you know, it was pretty rough and tumble, and just a very different culture, you know, our Indigenous culture to a Pacific Island nation. And so that was different. It was very different for me to get used to that.
Tell me about your first work experience, when you got your work experience placement.
Well, for a very long time, I'd known that I'd wanted to go into nursing since I was 8.
Why did you want to do nursing from 8?
My brother had an operation in the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, and, you know, the nurses were wearing the white stockings and the white dresses and the white caps, and they were very, very wonderful to my brother, and I was just really intrigued at what their job was. And it stuck in my head that that's what I wanted to do, and I never diverged. And so when I was 15 and, you know, in Tennant Creek High School, I was given the opportunity to do work experience at the hospital, and, you know, small town, country hospital, the orderly just happened to be wandering by, and he was also the, you know, autopsy assistant for the pathologist, and he knew me and just asked if I'd like to come to an autopsy, and of course I said yes. There wasn't a lot of clinical supervision when I look back that the orderly could kidnap me from the wards and take me to an autopsy.
And were you keen, though?
Very keen.
Yeah? You weren't going, thinking, I better say yes, but I'm terrified.
Oh, no. I was intrigued. And unfortunately, it was a gentleman who, an Indigenous gentleman who'd gone missing out bush probably 3 days earlier, a little bit of dementia, and he'd wandered off. And so it was, you know, it wasn't the easiest of autopsies, I guess, on the scale of autopsies, but I was pretty intrigued. And the orderly would do all the preparation, you know, which involved getting things ready for the pathologist. And, you know, he was going through all of that with me at a very microscopic level.
Did you have any idea of what the inside of someone looked like until that moment?
No. I mean, you know, from the textbooks, I had an idea of what, you know, what was in there, but 3D is just another world, and that just confirmed to me again that this was fascinating, and I was really interested in the human body. The smell was not pleasant, I won't lie. There was nothing nice about that, but we had masks and just got on with that bit.
So having made that decision you wanted to be a nurse, how did you start? Where did you get your training?
So I started as an enrolled nurse in 1982 in Alice Springs, and I was able to do that there for 3 years, and then knew that I wanted to do my general training, my registered nurse training. You know, the transition to university was happening, and I was able to get into the very last group in Darwin, so to do the general.
Was it everything you thought it would be?
Again, it was more. I just remember, like, from the first day in Alice, just being very, very proud. We still had the caps then. So I was very proud when I put on my old floppy white cap, you know, that you meant to starch, and, you know, pranced around Todd Street in Alice Springs wearing my hat to do shopping. Oh, geez. Very corny. A little row of us going shopping because we're all so proud of our white caps.
Hello, did you know I'm a nurse?
Yes. It's dreadful when I look back, I blush. But no, from day one, it was exactly what I wanted to do and, yeah, never looked back.
How are conditions as a nurse in the Territory different from the rest of Australia?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to compare because I've only sort of left the Territory after 31 years in the job. I left in August last year. And so I had an idea that things were rather different, just, you know, interaction with colleagues and conferences and things. But not until I really got out did I kind of just stand back and go, wow, you know, that was a big career. The Territory is extremely unique. It's just such an amazing place to work. And I was really privileged to work in a number of different communities and the hospitals. You know, we've obviously got third world health in a first world country, and that's very confronting at times. Some of the things that, you know, I've dealt with over the years that seem to make, unfortunately, a little edgeway with the funding that does go into it.
We do know about this being the case for Aboriginal mm-hmm. people in the Territory. Is that true in the broader population to some degree as well? Was it mostly Indigenous?
No, definitely. The Territory's got some challenges. There's a very large alcohol intake in the Northern Territory as well, much larger than the rest of Australia per capita. And there's also a trauma load, three times the national average per capita of trauma. And so, you know, that comes with very long distances of driving, people not wearing seatbelts, the open speed limits, and people driving drunk and overloading their cars, and a lot of tourists driving on the wrong side of the road. So it's absolutely multifactorial. There's also a huge level of domestic violence and assault, and often that's because of the substance abuse. And so, you know, that was my bread and butter for many years in emergency.
How was it for you as a young girl squaring up to that?
Wow. Well, you know, that first year in Alice Springs, as a 17-year-old, that was a little confronting, even though, you know, I'd come from tenant to be immersed in a hospital situation and suddenly, you know, classed as an adult and working. That was different. I was, you know, I was assaulted probably three or four times in that first year, just getting used to approaching people. I was had an old man he was on the ground one day being nursed on the floor because he didn't want to be in his bed, and I'd sort of knelt down to, you know, fix something up for him, and next thing you know, I've got this huge bite on my breast and he's latched right on and was just biting me. And he was also eating a jam sayo biscuit, so I had all these teeth marks and sort of had to pat him on the head to get him off. That was a little surprise.
But you weren't trained how to deal with that, were you?
That didn't come up in the book. I was strangled by oxygen tubing when I had my back to a patient as well, and pulled back onto the bed, and luckily the doctor saved me because it was getting really tight.
What brings on this kind of psychotic behaviour?
Well,
alcohol?
Alcohol, dementia, violence. I mean, I could sit here and take over your show, Richard, talking about violence in emergency departments in Australia. It's frightening, the number of assaults that, you know, I've witnessed or, you know, been privy to over the years. And, you know, we've got to a point now where we don't tolerate it, and we really certainly try and press charges if we can. Alcohol's not an excuse, drugs aren't an excuse, you know. And so, unfortunately, society's really, really changed. When I was younger, doctors and nurses said, you know, they had a bit of respect from the public, but I don't see that much anymore. And so you have to be very prepared and have a lot of, you know, aggression awareness training to do the job.
There's all sorts of issues with Indigenous health in mm-hmm. the Territory. Tell me about the man who came to you with a glass eye with a problem.
Oh, gosh. It was really early days in Alice Springs. So, and a lot of people were still coming in out of the Western Desert and suddenly being admitted to the Alice Springs Hospital for strange things. And, you know, that was just such a bizarre thing for them to be in this building, you know, air conditioning, elevators. I was so scared of elevators and hated the air conditioning. So most of our patients in Alice and Darwin still live outside. You know, you go to look for your patients, they're all outside with blankets. And the man with the glass eye that I nursed, he had a glass eye put in after an eye injury, and he'd had it in for 17 years when I met him. And he'd come in with an infection, and we couldn't figure out the source of the infection. There was pus coming from behind the glass eye, and we removed that. And that was an Australian flag. It was really quite cute to see this on an old tribal Walpri man wearing an Aussie flag glass eye. But when we removed it, you know, that was the source of the infection behind it, because he hadn't been given instructions about, you know, taking it out and cleaning it. And so it was actually fly blown and had made him very ill.
Behind the glass eye.
I remember him in particular, he had a phone call at the front desk, and I went to get him, and he'd never used the telephone before. He hadn't seen one. He couldn't believe, I think he thought I was performing black magic, because there was, you know, a voice of a relative out, you know, at Kintore coming through the phone, and he couldn't believe this invention. And when he finally realised how it was all working, and he was delighted, couldn't get him off the front desk after that. Loved the phone.
There was a ward there for kids who were sniffing petrol. Tell me about that.
There was two areas that struck me the most. I was in a medical ward, again, really young myself, and in a medical ward with 18 petrol sniffers, and they were all withdrawing from petrol, and they would constantly be hallucinating and fighting each other and us, and I had to break up a fight once between, you know, a patient with a knife and fork. They were fighting with their cutlery.
How old are these?
The youngest one that I looked after was 12, and then the rest in the medical ward were generally young boys. People didn't live very long. You know, it was really high lead. It was before the Avgas came in, and we were giving chelation therapy to remove the lead from their system every day, and that was, you know, shocking treatment in itself. I saw a girl of 12 die in Alice Springs Hospital. She'd been in for 3 weeks, and she was ready to actually be discharged, and I went on to an evening shift, and she started to have an ear bleed, and she was going home the next day. So, you know, as the young nurse, I went and reported it to the sister, and she said, oh, you know, just keep an eye on it and, you know, do some observations. So I did, and probably an hour or two later, her nose started to bleed, and, you know, that was a bit concerning, and I really couldn't stop this bleeding from, you know, the nose, the ear. And by the end of my evening shift, she was bleeding from every orifice and her observations were just deteriorating. And I knocked off at 11:30, and when I came on at 7:30, she'd just died. And that was from petrol sniffing. So it's a disease called disseminated intravascular coagulation, where your clotting factors just can't clot anymore because of the lead. And so that was heartbreaking. I couldn't believe that, because she'd seemed so well to me. It took me a long time to understand that disorder. That was really bad. I saw a lot of very confronting things with, you know, 12-year-old girls having babies. It was a totally different culture, and you had to just try and wrap your head around, you know, our world and their world, and, yeah, it was hard.
You became an emergency nurse, which is what you do now, and that's what you love the most. What was the work like in Alice on a Friday night as an emergency nurse?
Alice was a war zone. That's where I cut, you know, I think I really cut my teeth there. And developed some pretty swift suturing skills. You know, Alice was such, it had such alcohol-related violence issues going on, and so many nomadic people coming from very different communities and trying to all mix in Alice Springs. And so there was a lot of wars going on, and people would fight, and the weapons of choice would be nulla nullas or star pickets or spears. And so that led to, you know, you can imagine lots and lots of lacerations. So it was nothing for 40 people to be sitting in the waiting room of Alice Springs Hospital on a Friday night, on most nights really. But we didn't have emergency specialists. They weren't a specialty at that stage in Australia. And so GPs on call would come to assist us. So, you know, getting a doctor was tough. And so I'd often be myself rostered on with, I remember this little French registered nurse who would disappear all the time. And I later found out, you know, she was drinking champagne in medical records, and I'd have this emergency department with 40 people in it trying to sew them all up and wondering, you know, where my colleagues were.
And she's drinking champagne.
Off in medical records. I don't think she could cope very well with the whole scene. And you know, when you're a very young nurse, you're not sort of, you don't confront the sister. You didn't. So, you know, I used to just have to deal with it.
Part of your work was to be sent out for a stint in remote communities.
Yes.
Tell me about the first community you were sent out to.
I went to Warrabri, Ellicorong it's called these days, and that's about 240 kilometres. I think it's northeast of Alice Springs, really in the middle of nowhere again. And virtually, you know, having a lot of those formative years in the Territory, I was still absolutely shocked when I got to that community, just the level of poverty and violence, alcoholism. There was no plumbing to speak of. And, you know, of course, housing was just so incredibly overcrowded. We'd sort of closed the clinic. We were actually, the nurses had great big iron gates and had to be locked in their flat. Our units were in a cage because, you know, when people would get drunk, the target would be the nursing staff. And, you know, there's certainly rapes and assaults. And so the police would lock the huge gates around our flats. And then, you know, if we had to respond to something, we'd be unlocked and escorted to the staff.
How were you able to help a man who had an epileptic attack?
That was probably one of the strangest times in my career out in the bush. I guess it's not something you'd see much at all anymore in rural Australia. The old humpies, they were built of straw and, you know, thatch, bits of twig and paper. That's what people lived in. There was certainly some tin shacks, but humpies were also fairly prevalent. And I was called to a situation with an Aboriginal health worker, to a man that was having an epileptic fit. And when we got to the community, the health worker pointed to the humpy for me. He said, "You go in, he's crazy." And I said, "So what, you want me to go by myself?" He said, "Yeah, he's mad." I thought, great. So I grabbed the drug box and I had some Valium prepared on the way so I knew what I had to do. But as I crawled in to this humpy, which is not something I'd regularly visited before, I just remember, you know, crawling in and here's this poor man having a huge seizure and he had four little dogs in there as well. And I looked up, you know, to the feathers and the twigs and everything thatched over my head and, you know, I thought, oh, here I am in a humpy with a man having a grand mal seizure and I'm trying to get control of his leg to give him an injection. It's just, it was the most bizarre feeling right in the middle of nowhere in Australia. But, you know, it worked and we got him out, so.
You were in Alice Springs mm-hmm. on that famous day in 1983 when a disgruntled and angry truckie decided yes. he was thrown out for public drunkenness mm-hmm. and then decided to ram his whole semi-trailer in a carriage into the bar of the motel there, just mm-hmm. near Uluru.
Yes.
And you were on duty then. What do you remember of that day? That night, I should say.
Yeah, I remember getting news from the Inland Motel at some stage in casualty saying that this had happened and you know, that we needed to set up a disaster plan at Alice Springs Hospital.
Well, how did you respond when you were told a man had driven a semi into a bar?
I was a little surprised, but, you know, the Territory was full of, like, the Stuart Highway was one lane and there was trucks everywhere, huge road trains without restrictions. You know, they'd have four or five carriages and overtaking those were always a challenge. But, you know, I just thought he'd been a bloody idiot, really. And
I thought it was an accident.
Oh, no, yeah. No, I knew that he'd been pissed, you know, he must have been pissed to do it. excuse my language.
He was pissed, yeah.
Yes, and so I knew that there'd be alcohol involved, but I didn't realise, you know, it didn't unfold till later the true extent that, yes, he had been refused service because he was being extremely, you know, drunk and belligerent at the bar and he'd been tossed out. He did actually take two of the three carriages off. So he didn't take the full truck through, but he certainly gave the Inlander, you know, he basically took down the pub.
Do you know anyone who was in that bar that night?
Yes, the father of my two children, my first husband, was in the bar and he'd actually had a shout. So he was a generous man and he was up at the bar and unfortunately two of the people that he'd been sitting with were killed, two of the five that were killed, and I think we got 16 injured into our hospital as well over many hours. Alice Springs lost all communication with Ayers Rock at the stage and, you know, the phones, just the whole network just dropped out and, you know, it was a state of confusion for a long time.
So they were all brought to you in Alice then?
There
were five dead
injured.
And there were 16 injured, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, slowly they came through and obviously they were pretty shocked at what you know, sitting in the middle of a bar in the middle of Ayers Rock, and a truck comes through. It's not what you expect.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on air, online, and on digital radio. You can subscribe totally free to Conversations podcast. Details on the website abc.net.au/conversations.
You're listening to my conversation from earlier this year with nurse practitioner Ronnie Taylor. Ronnie is based in Meriden Hospital, which is east of Perth. She's worked in Pakistan after the floods. She's treated patients after both the Bali bombings and after the Ashmore Reef emergency. You went to Darwin after you've been in Alice for a while.
Yes.
Tell me about the day you helped a lady give birth, not in the hospital, but right in front of the hospital.
Mm-hmm. We'd just built a new department in Darwin, a very nice new emergency department, and still just, you know, sort of teething all our procedures and things. And I suppose the public was still trying to get their head around where to pull up and drop off. And next thing, one of the nurses had run into our ED out the back and, you know, yelled out, is there a midwife here at all? And, you know, slowly put my hand up and said, yeah. And she said, I need help out the front now. And so we grabbed a trolley and I just grabbed some gloves and a sheet and off we went. And I, you know, assumed that I'd have time to get her back into ED at least.
Like the emergency department, you mean? Yeah.
Yes. So I was wrong with my assumption, unfortunately. When I ran out, the man had unloaded her from the car. And so we popped her straight on the trolley and I handed the guy at the end of the bed, I gave him the sheet to hold up, or just why I did a quick check because I think, you know, she's pushing. And unfortunately, yes, the head was on view, so we couldn't really go anywhere. And I thought, well, we'll just deliver and
right,
go.
This is right in front
of the hospital.
And were there people there?
There's people everywhere. It's busier than Bourke Street at Royal Darwin Hospital. Like I said, most of our patients live outside.
And are there cameras?
So there's cameras. At that stage, the security cameras were still being ironed out. And we had a couple that were taking camera shots of the front entrance of emergency, and those were being beamed back onto a television in the waiting room. And so I delivered this lovely little baby girl, and poor mum, you know, she just didn't know what was happening. I don't think she could have cared if she was on Mars, you know, but she was just wanting to get it out.
So you put the sheet up. You got the guy.
The guy was holding the sheet.
For privacy.
Yes. And when I went to give mum the baby, you know, she was just too exhausted. And so I sort of, you know, had a towel and I'd wrapped the baby in that and turned around, you know, to congratulate Dad and pass him the baby. And he said to me, I'm not the father. And I said, I'm sorry, who are you? He said, I was just walking past. You gave me the sheet. Dad came up the path, you know, not long afterwards, and I congratulated the right man. But I was so embarrassed. And this poor fellow, he looked quite chuffed with himself.
So you just grabbed this complete stranger and said, hold this sheet.
Walker by, and he got the whole full frontal view. And so when we went back into ED with the woman, all the waiting room crowd was clapping because they'd seen, you know, coming through the footage as well. So I announced that it was a girl and everyone was happy. So it was a nice, you know, it was a joyous moment, but yeah, a bit of a faux pas sort of doing it right at the front there, I think.
It was a good day though, overall.
Oh, wonderful. It's lovely when, yeah, nice things happen in ED like that. It's great.
About the time that you came to the rescue of a frill neck lizard. this was perhaps your hardest. It was demanding.
It was.
Job.
It was one of my darkest hours, I think, too. But I gave it my all. I was in my pool in Darwin and I just about to hop in and I saw a frilly floating and struggling and, you know, a decent sized frill neck. So obviously, you know, I ascertained that it had drowned and got a net and was able to get it out. And I noticed a very faint heartbeat. And it's
what do you mean? You had your finger on its...
No. So I had it. It was lying on its back in my net.
And you could
and
just
see it. And I could see the little heart beating.
Right.
But as I'm watching it, it stopped. And I thought, well, you know, it's a witnessed arrest. And, you know, there's a procedure for that, which is usually or used to be a thump straight onto the heart. But I just proceeded to do cardiac massage with two fingers and just I did a pediatric rate because it was small. And so I thought, well, if I do the same rate as you do for a child, you know, I'd give it a fighting chance.
How do you do CPR on a full neck lizard?
Well, I'd seen the spot where the heart was beating and so I knew where it
was. So when you got two fingers and you
went? Yeah, two fingers and I just started counting and giving it a little gentle cardiac massage. I wasn't going to do mouth-to-mouth at any stage though. The tongue was hanging out and there was blood, you know, on the mouth. And so I gave puffs of air.
What do you mean? You blew into its mouth?
Yeah, well, I blew onto its face more.
Oh, right.
Didn't actually lock lips.
Was anyone watching you do this and going, what are you doing?
No, but when I finally, had success and...
It worked.
It worked. I resuscitated the lizard and he looked so much better. And I took him up to the house and my husband was in there and I said, I've just resuscitated the lizard from the pool. I think I need to put him on the barbecue to dry out. The Barbie was turned off. So we popped him on the Barbie and he was there for about 6 hours. And I did a few, you know, frequent observation checks and he lived for 6 hours and then he died.
Oh, well, he had six hours.
Yeah. That's a bit sad.
Were you sad after
I seriously thought that I'd got him back for good. I did. He looked so good after post-arrest that I was a bit disappointed, but gave it my all.
That's exactly the kind of story that makes the front page of the NT News, did
yes.
it?
No, it didn't actually. And you're right, the NT News would have absolutely loved that. But I kept that pretty quiet. You know, it was certainly a joke among friends, you know, at parties. It'd come up and I'd just, I resuscitated frilly and people just look at you. What did she just say? But it was, great.
Well, I think that's lovely you did. Yeah, good on you for doing that too. One of the finest hours of Darwin Hospital was how it was able to respond to victims of the Bali bombing in 2005. Tell me about that day when you found out that Bali had been bombed and you began to realise that patients would be coming your way out of Bali.
I knew fairly early. I guess the bombing happened at midnight and I was up early that morning and had seen, you know, some bits and pieces on Sky News. I knew that, you know, Australians had been affected and other nationalities, and it kind of crossed my mind, given Darwin's proximity to Bali, whether Darwin would actually respond to that. And then probably about 2 o'clock that afternoon, I got a phone call. You better come in. We are going to respond.
And so that gave you, what, a couple of hours or something?
Oh, it gave us so many hours, Richard. That's why we were very successful with the response, I think, was the huge lead in time that we had. So it was 23 hours after the bombing when we started to see our first wave of patients.
And what was your role once they came in?
I stayed at triage. I was at triage for 28 hours. When I look back, it was just crazy. But that was our first really big disaster. Australia had Granville train disaster in Sydney years ago, but this was our first big one coming across the ocean and, you know, victims of terrorism. You know, we didn't have really good plans, I guess, on how long you keep your staff on the ground. And so my job was to work with the emergency department director, try and decide where to put people. It got worse and worse there for a long time. The burns just got so severe. And, you know, in the end, we were putting people with 70% burns in our outpatient area. Any other day, you know, they'd be straight into a resus room, but our resus rooms were already overloaded. There was a couple that were absolutely what I'd call indeterminate sex, so you didn't know if it was a male or a female, and the documentation was very variable from Sanglah. You know, obviously they're under a huge amount of pressure. They'd run out of morphine, they'd run out of fluids, burns cream, you know, all that equipment, and we had been sending some, but still not enough. And so these people were coming in, you know, fairly well traumatised and a lot of them unconscious. And so we just, for a little while, we weren't sure exactly who we were dealing with.
How do they feel to see you?
They were extremely grateful to be back on Australian soil. I can never imagine what they went through. You know, people thrown into swimming pools just to try and to cool down. They were thrown into back of garbage trucks to try and get to the hospital. So there was just stories upon stories coming out from these patients. And Many of them weren't linked up with their families. You know, many of them weren't, especially weren't from Darwin. Most of them were from interstate.
So did you have the phone off the hook, ringing off the hook from worried families?
Yes, we had the fax machine and the phone. The switchboard operators had, you can't imagine the phone calls our switchboard operators were taking for from Australian nationals trying to find their families and overseas. Photos of missing people and people asking, you know, have we spotted their mum or their dad? Or, oh, it's just overwhelming.
You could have spent all your time on the phone, couldn't you? Taking calls from really worried people who were genuinely really upset and worried. But your first job is, of course, to treat the sick and wounded.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, the community almost overwhelms a hospital with wanting to help as well, and that's fantastic. But I guess there wasn't processes, you know, for volunteers and we learned a lot from it. And I guess, you know, uppermost was that we were in a very strategic location at the gateway to Southeast Asia in the top of Australia. And that's what John Howard saw with the first Bali bombing, was when the National Critical Care Trauma Response Centre was established.
And what was your role then at that new centre?
I had left the emergency department as the charge nurse of ED by that stage, and had gone up to the centre as one of the trauma clinical nurse managers. And so we were case managing major trauma patients throughout the hospital. We would meet people in the emergency department after their accident, and we would make sure that all the right teams, you know, the general surgeons talking to the orthopaedic surgeons, that we had physio and OT and social work. And we were like almost like an independent body for the family and the patient. So, you know, if they were having trouble in different areas of the hospital, you know, they could let us know their concerns and we could kind of troubleshoot that. We were able to reduce the length of stay and the trajectory of, you know, a patient's trauma journey by many, many days through this model. And it was only from the funding, you know, that was allowed with the NCCTRC that let us do that.
You were brought into Pakistan as part of a team to assist in that country. What was the natural disaster that brought that response?
That was the massive flood in 2010 of the Indus River. And we were dropped into the Punjab, if you like, probably 4 or 5 weeks after the flood. 20 million people were dispossessed and, you know, millions dead.
So you weren't treating injuries as a result of the flood so much as what disease, communicable diseases, that kind of thing.
Sure. As a trauma nurse, yeah, there wasn't a lot of trauma there for me as such, but it was more public health and the midwifery child health side of things. Absolutely phenomenal rates of malaria and the gastrointestinal illnesses, lots and lots of very sick and malnourished children and mothers. The women did really poorly there because they weren't exactly first-class citizens, I guess, in that structure of society. You know, the men had to eat and the boys first, and so that was fairly confronting. There was probably 15 people on our team there, and most of them were from the territory, so we were already very acclimatised to the extreme weather that we were facing, although I'd never faced anything like Pakistan in those floods. And the third world health stuff. So a lot of that tropical medicine, infectious diseases, we're exposed to all the time in the top end. So I think we transitioned pretty smoothly into the middle of the Punjab.
How about you being a woman treating men or boys in that situation? Was that an issue, or were those things just cast aside in an emergency?
No. So our male nurses and doctors weren't allowed to treat the women. I was allowed to treat men, but well, you'd try and speak to them directly, but it was like you were invisible and they would just answer straight to the interpreter. So in the end, I was just sort of asking the interpreter questions and they would give the answers from the patient back to me.
How many people was your team able to treat?
We saw about 12,000 patients.
12,000 patients?
It was very, very busy. I think altogether 7 weeks of deployment. I think I'd had five. And 12,000 went through our tent hospital. We were part of a military Air Force-led mission, tri-services, but Air Force-led, just because of security issues. And so we had military doctors and nurses with us as well.
Were women curious about what you were doing?
Oh, women were fascinated.
Well, how did they show that?
Well, really by lining up to see me. I had a line one day of a lot of quite well-looking children and women, And, you know, I said to the interpreter when this big line of people were waiting, I said, you know, what are they all doing like together? They all seem to be in one group. And she said, oh, they've come to see you. I said, what do you mean? And she said, because, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes, you know, they wanted to actually see you. And they're not used to women working very confidently and giving orders and bossing men around.
Did you like that? Did you like being
Yes. I felt like I was, you know, Jermaine Greer in the middle of Pakistan. No, it was just so very different. It was very, very different for me to be there. And I think they enjoyed the fact that you could be more autonomous and educated. I mean, we were right in the middle of a very rural area, the food basket of Pakistan. There was probably 3% of the female population were actually going to school. So
this is incredibly poor places. There's almost no education. They're very, very conservative agrarian societies.
Yes.
Do you feel they reluctant to judge, or you couldn't help yourself, or what? I mean,
it's a really good question. I was fascinated with it all. It had never been on my, you know, holiday list as such, but really privileged to be there. And I didn't sort of judge. I just let things be, I guess, because I wasn't going to change it in my little 5-week stint. But I still have friendships with some of those interpreters, and, you know, I hope I've inspired, you know, a little bit of confidence for them to pursue education.
Was your work appreciated?
Oh, yeah, they were very, very, very grateful that Australia had, you know, again helped. Pretty incredible country, and, you know, with our funding, they were just pretty overwhelmed that we'd been there, I think.
With Ronnie Taylor, who's a nurse practitioner at the Emergency Department at Meriden Hospital in WA, for much of her life she was based in hospitals in the Territory, and she's been part of emergency relief efforts in Pakistan and in the Philippines, which is more recently. Now, you were asked to go there after the recent typhoon. This was at Tacloban, wasn't it?
It was there. In Tacloban, yeah.
Did you hesitate when they said, come to the Philippines?
No, I didn't. I knew it wasn't going to be fun as such, like the conditions, you know, that we were seeing through the media.
What kind of conditions did you see when you got there?
I was, I think, lucky in the fact that I was on Team Bravo, so that was the second team in. We came in to relieve our first medical team, Alpha. Our colleagues were absolutely just so very exhausted when I saw them. I knew that we were going to be in for a big time. They'd really had to build a tent hospital from scratch. They had the worst of the conditions, I think. You know, coming on Team Bravo, things were already a little bit set up for us. And they certainly had, you know, very, very high trauma load, people that were getting trapped in the floods and the debris. So when your lander struck, there'd been the immense winds plus 3, you know, tsunami-like tidal waves come in. So there was damage not only from the winds but also from these huge waves.
So what, the place was flattened then, was it?
Flattened and flooded. And, you know, look at a public car park in Darwin, Casuarina Car Park underground, that's used for cyclone response for the public to go and hide, you know, to be sheltered in. And that's what happened in Tacloban. They put people all in these underground car parks, not aware that there was, you know, tsunami coming through. And so thousands were just drowned, trapped and drowned. And every patient had a story about their relatives or their families. You know, so many lost so much. These people were living on pieces of cardboard. And to see the conditions that people living in I can only imagine, you know, you see movies and imagine what Armageddon looks like. That's what Tacloban looked like to me 3 weeks on by the time I got there, and there was still, you know, 3 stories high of debris with cars sitting on the top of it. And you just can't imagine the sheer terror and the damage. And so we were dealing a lot, you know, with that emotional stuff from the patients as well as a lot of physical issues.
I don't know if this is a fair question to ask, but do you get to a point where you don't want to hear the stories? Would you rather just do the treatments and not have this
sadness? Yeah. You do get a little bit, like, you just don't know what's coming next, and they seem to be getting worse as it went on. Maybe that was my, you know, tolerance sort of lowering, but yeah, I do. I've got to say that sometimes it's best just not to know, but they really wanted to talk. They really wanted to tell you their story as well. And so, you know, I think it's therapeutic that you'd let them do that. And, you know, it's tough because you just sort of, you're constantly thinking about it for a while.
How long do you think it'll take them to recover from that typhoon?
I think probably about 10 years, seriously. Everything was just gone. It's going to take years and years and years. The Filipino people were just overwhelmed again at Australia being there. I guess there's a real tie, you know, with so many Filipino people that live in Australia anyway. They couldn't be any more grateful. It was amazing.
Do you have any time for yourself when you're in that situation? That's a silly question too, I know, I suppose.
No. Well, you know, that mission, it was basically 16, 18-hour shifts and no time at all for yourself, really. You're just so bone tired when you get back to the tent that you just collapse. I had a very sad situation there on nights, and that was really tough. And I had a little child that I was nursing, and my colleague that night was another nurse practitioner from the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. This child had some very expert nursing staff for the night and, you know, medical staff during the day.
What was wrong with her?
It was malnourished with the cyclone and dreadful fluid and electrolyte imbalance that we really couldn't correct, you know, without having the right diagnostic equipment. You know, we were virtually running a critical care unit in our little hospital, but there gets to a point where you've got to, you know, say in disaster medicine, you know, how much more can we do here? You know, we can't pack all these patients up and take them with us, and we can't stay forever. And so you had to sort of, you know, have some pretty ethical decision making at times. But we knew that we had done, you know, everything that we could for this child, and basically, you know, the child was dying, and, you know, our care had become palliative, really. And the mother was, you know, absolutely exhausted, and she was asleep on her little, you know, tent mattress. And my colleague had gone out, you know, to have a break, and I was just standing, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, I was standing over the little child, and I felt myself get really teary and just so sad, because I knew that if we were in Australia, you know, this was a salvageable thing. And, you know, really there was just nothing we could do in those conditions and to what we would send people home to, which was nothing, you know. They had absolutely nothing. And so I was quite sad, and I felt, you know, and I don't cry much at work anymore at all, but, you know, I did. I felt very teary and tired. And then I looked up, and there was probably about 30 people in the ward, and they were all just staring at me, all the Filipinos. So all the patients would come in with their families. The families would do a lot of the care and the nursing. It's a cultural thing, and bring a lot of the food in as well.
Why were they there staring at you?
Look, people didn't seem to sleep. It was incredible. And I think part of that was a lot of mental trauma. A lot of people would be up at night, but I think they realised that there was a very sick baby in their midst. And, you know, very Catholic country, I think they were all praying. And, you know, and so they're looking at me, and I'd sort of stood there and was looking back at them. And
do you think that they're all keeping an eye on you to see, because you're the person who can, and if a nurse is crying, then it's like a flight attendant crying, isn't it? I'm serious.
Yeah,
you know,
the
it's
plane's
like that.
Going down.
You know, do you think that might have been why?
I think they felt sad that I was still sad as well, you know, and they were just compassionate too. And
what did they do?
Well, you know, I got some pats on the back. Someone handed me a pair of rosary beads, and my colleague came back, and, you know, that's what I needed, was her to just pat me on the back and cuddle and say, right, you know, tune for your coffee. And so I stepped out and had a break and came back and felt, you know, much better. And we, by this stage, you know, got Mum up into the bed and
With the child
and got her as prepared as we could, and gave her the best little send-off that we could. And, you know, we were surrounded by a team of logisticians. We couldn't function without our logisticians. They're like ex-fireys or military. They build things, they cook things. And they built a little coffin for the baby. They had some wood, you know, so they were finding wood strewn everywhere with the disaster. And they were able to build a little coffin. And the mother was really, you know, extremely overwhelmed by that.
You were too, of course.
Mm. Yeah.
So now you shifted from the territory to Perth.
Mm. Well, I'm not in Perth. I'm out in the middle of the country. I've had a dust change. I'm 3 hours
east
of Perth.
Well, you've had a dust change.
I was going for a sea change. I was heading, my family and I were heading east to Queensland, but a contract came up in the middle of the wheat belt of Western Australia, a three-month contract for a nurse practitioner in a tiny little country emergency department. So you're 3 hours east of Perth. And the country hospital and the folk have just been so fabulous that I've actually extended that contract now for 3 years.
I love the idea of calling it a dust change. Is that a thing? Is that going to take off,
do you think? I don't know.
We're all going to be doing it?
A dust change. Well, no, I don't think you'll all be doing it, but I love it. And
But before you came in, you said to me that you feel really lucky to have had the job you've had. Do you really mean that? I mean, you've seen terrible things that if I saw them, I think I'd never get over them. Do you really think of yourself as a lucky person for having done this? I mean, I can think of other great things to say about your life, which is it's meaningful, incredibly meaningful, and all those other things. But lucky is interesting. Why lucky?
Well, lucky. Isn't it wonderful if you get to do a job that you truly, truly love? And every day, you know, it's just great to, like, I really enjoy work. I'm not saying I don't have the off day at all, because I do, but on the whole, that just gives me so much more energy to keep going to work because I really enjoy it. And I teach lots and lots these days. I do a lot of teaching with fellow nurses and medical students and medical staff and AMBOs, and I've got a lot to offer back and a lot of stories to tell, and the staff love it. Got a bit of street cred after this amount of time.
You do have street cred, and you do have stories to tell. I'm so glad you were able to tell them here. Thank you so much. It's been
pleasure.
Great to meet you, Ronnie.
Okay, it's fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.